Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tate Modern. My name is Marco Daniel. I'm curator of public programs, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you here tonight to Teddy Cruz and Pedro Reyes for the second in our series of architecture and art collaboration and crossover. This wonderful series curated by the Architecture Foundation in conjunction with Tate Modern. Sarah Chioka, the director of the Architecture Foundation, is the chair of this evening's talk, and I'll hand you over to her now for an introduction to this evening's event.
Thank you so much, Marco, and many thanks are due to Marco and Amber McClory and the rest of the team at Tate. We're delighted at the foundation to be strengthening our longstanding relationship with Tate Modern through this series. I'd also like to take the opportunity to thank our assistant curator, Justin Jakeley, and all of the AF team whose effort is behind tonight. As Marco began to say, the Architecture and Art series of conversation aims to offer diverse international examples of architects and artists working in dialogue. The series also aims to advance the debate about the nature of collaborative practice and the conflicts, similarities, and divergences in architects' and artists' creative approaches and the resulting products. The series began last week with a very lively discussion between Vito Acconci and Stephen Hull about their collaboration designing the facade of New York's Storefront for Art and Architecture Gallery. And that, along with all of the other talks in this series, will be available to watch on the AF website in the coming weeks. Tonight's talk will in turn be followed by the artists Elm Green and Dragset in conversation with the architect Jamie Fobert on Monday the 22nd of June. And more details of the series and the rest of our summer program, Shameless Pitch, is available in the AF Bulletin, which should have been on your seat, as is an evaluation form, which we'd be very grateful for your feedback in at the end of this evening's talk. I should also say this series is made possible with the very generous support of the estate of Francis Bacon and the Arts Council England. This evening offers the latest installment of an evolving dialogue between Teddy Cruz, who is an architect who teaches at a school of visual arts, if I'm correct, and Pedro Reyes, an artist who first trained as an architect. To introduce you to them, to those who don't know, Teddy Cruz was born in Guatemala City. After earning the Rome Prize in Architecture and obtaining a master's in design studies at the Harvard Graduate School of Design, Cruz established his practice in San Diego, California in the year 2000. He's been recognized internationally for his urban research on the Tijuana-San Diego border and in collaboration with community-based nonprofit organizations such as Casa Familiar for his work on housing and its relationship to an urban policy which is more inclusive of social and cultural programs for the city. In 2004, Cruz was the first recipient of the James Sterling Memorial Lecture on the City Prize, which is organized by the Canadian Center for Architecture and the London School of Economics. And in 2008, Cruz was selected to represent the United States at the Venice Architecture Biennale. He is currently an associate professor in public culture and urbanism in the Visual Arts Department at the University of California, San Diego. Pedro Reyes was born, lives, and works in Mexico City. Reyes's art addresses the interplay between physical and social space, making tangible the invisible geometry of human relationships. Trained as an architect, Reyes often relies on models and drawings to prepare sculptures, functional objects, and architecture. This design practice reveals a parallel interest in the formal properties of objects, as well as the psychodynamics of public participation. Reyes's expanded notion of sculpture examines the cognitive contradictions of modern life and the possibility of overcoming our particular crises by increasing our individual and collective degrees of agency. Reyes's work has been shown in multiple institutions throughout the world, including the CCA Kitakyushu, South London Gallery, the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago, the Reina Sofia Madrid, PS1 New York, Kunstwerk Berlin, Museo Estudio Luis Berrigan, Mexico, the Yokohama Triennale, and the Shanghai and Venice Biennales. Recent shows in the U.S. include Prospect 1, New Orleans, the Bass Museum of Art, Miami, and the San Francisco Art Institute. Teddy Cruz and Pedro Reyes' conversation first began on the page, as I understand it, in a conversation arranged by Modern Painters magazine in late 2007, and then continued into last year in the form of an exhibition at the San Francisco Art Institute, which we'll hear much more about this evening. The structure of the evening is that we'll begin with an alternating presentation in which Teddy and Pedro will tell us about several key projects they have each worked on, and then use this as a prompt for discussion of some emerging common concerns and principles in their practice. Then please make sure that you have clever questions at the ready, because we will open the discussion to include the audience following that. Teddy, would you like to kick off?
Let's begin. Thank you for inviting. And different, I guess, to the collaboration, I imagine, maybe I could mention this very quickly, between Vito Acconci and Stephen Hall that some of you might have witnessed last week, where they actually worked on the project specifically. In our case, I think our collaboration has been an ongoing dialogue. It's not really about a project, but really about sharing a series of issues and problematics that really have inspired the work. So we were brought together by Modern Painters, the magazine, which basically invited us to meet in Mexico City, and we were at the university, the UNAM in Mexico City, the National University, and we engaged in conversations where we had blackboards around where we were drawing and diagramming, and I think that a lot of the conversation began, in fact, as a critique or a question of the difference between drawing and diagramming, and mainly because I was educated in a typical sort of phenomenological tradition of poetics and metaphor, let's say. And lately, a lot of my drawings, because I love to draw a lot, and have been shelved, you know, and they have not really allowed me to enter into the politics and economics of development. So at some point, my interest began to really enter into the role of diagrams in more operative, let's say, aspects of intervention. And so that opened up a conversation about issues of representation and agency and activism and so on. And at that point, I think we began to realize that these definitions about art or architecture are really begin to blur, and that some of us that are working on the margins of our own fields begin to talk about this notion of this expanded idea of practice. And one of the most inspirational, probably, statements in the last 2-3 years that for me was essential came in the context of that notion of this expanded notion of practice, came from of the least expected source, came actually from the General Petraeus, the chief general of the American, the U.S. Army in Iraq, when he came back to the U.S. to give his first presentation or report to Congress. And he began by saying that the role of the contemporary soldier has to change. And the soldier is not anymore this almighty figure, robot-like, you know, dressed with the ultimate technological gadget, being able to control the enemy from a distance. But in fact, after his experience in Iraq, the contemporary soldier should be, in fact, he said, an anthropologist, a social worker, and versed in many languages. And it was unbelievable that it was coming from the mouth of General Petraeus. But in my mind and in our conversation, we began to speculate if the contemporary soldier has transformed, why can't we as architects, as artists, in the way of redefining our own institutions? That's how our conversation began.
Yes, and one of the elements in this exhibition that we made yesterday was, I think, that the fact of how could some of these pieces or projects could have a currency beyond the art audience or the architecture audience, no? Like sometimes engaging with other contexts that were, you know, like these projects required to be meaningful, even if the people we were addressing didn't read them as art or as architecture practice, no? Like, so many of the pieces are not only representation of cultural or cultural relationships or social relationships, but actually enable new relationships. And I think that the theme of the show, which was conflict resolution, was aimed to present these experiments in different cultural arenas, no? Like the idea of agency was very important, and also one of the elements is how we were using or propelling the institution to go beyond its standard audience and and change and become agents of transformation of its environment. No, I think that was like one of the common elements was that every of these, I mean, like it's probably more useful to show examples, but the idea was, you know, like to go beyond design and work in the living environment.
In the show, again, because our conversation did not involve the thinking together of one particular project, but we brought together our own pieces, let's say, of research, but they fit really in a very interesting way, and that's what has been an interesting issue, is this fluidity of concepts that, when brought together, form this exhibition, which is parts of that were on the screen. So we decided to maybe to frame the conversation today to go through some of these pieces and see where those commonalities and differences might exist and how that fueled, you know, the dialogue and the collaboration. So one first piece is this opportunity that I had, in fact, to intervene in the U.S. Pavilion at the Venice Biennale, the last one, last summer, where I had an amazing opportunity to be commissioned to do an installation on the facade of the U.S. Pavilion. And I took advantage of that as an opportunity to do something that I've been wanting to do in the region where I live, the border region between Tijuana, Mexico, and San Diego, California, this most intensive, most trafficked border in the world. And the piece was called Radicalizing the Local, 60 Linear Miles of Transborder Conflict. And this interest that I've had in suggesting the need to radicalize the local to understand the conditions of political and economic power inscribed in the territory as a point of departure to redefine a practice. And so literally, it was a cross-section of the border. I've been investigating a lot about the border itself and the communities adjacent to the border, but in this case, it was, in fact, a project that took me tangential to the border, 30 miles deep into San Diego, 30 miles deep into Tijuana. So it's 60 linear miles of transborder conflict. And along these 60 linear miles, again, beginning to pick up a series of conditions of conflict, of crisis, where top-down economic conditions, let's say, of development collide with bottom-up, whether environmental or ecological networks or social networks. And so beginning 30 miles deep into San Diego, understanding a series of environments, again, where these collisions are amplified, are very dramatized. So 30 miles deep into San Diego, the conflict between top-down development and the topography, as developers are destroying in a massive way the beautiful differential canyons of the edges of the city to install their cheap project of master plan gated communities, or the conflict between large infrastructure and the watershed as a large freeway traveling in Southern California clashes or collides with the natural hydrology of the land as it descends into the Pacific Ocean. The conflict between gated communities and everyday life, or as my friend Rebecca Solnit called it, the apartheid of social life in Southern California. The conflict between military bases and environmental zones, ironically the only places where the continuous development beginning in Los Angeles and ending in Tijuana is interrupted, is where the military bases are placed and ironically overlaid with environmentally protected zones. The conflict between the informal and the formal. I will get to this in a moment, as immigrants have begun to retrofit the urbanization of Southern California with difference. The conflict between two border cities that collide, repel each other as they also juxtapose. And as we cross into Tijuana, the conflict between the Tijuana River and the border as they collide tangentially, believe it or not, the political and the natural, and that's where the checkpoint is placed. The conflict between the informal and the natural ecologies as also shantytowns encroach into the natural or ecological networks. The conflict between factories and emergency housing in the edges of Tijuana. The conflict between sprawl and density as Tijuana has begun to import the patterns of development of the United States or Southern California. And finally, at the end of the 60 linear miles, probably the mama of all conflicts, the conflict between the political and the natural as the border wall, after traveling miles and miles through the Tijuana territory, finally sinks into the Pacific Ocean, and that's the image that I decided to amplify and to be the main panorama that was actually displayed on the facade of the U.S. Pavilion. These 60 linear miles of transborder conflict, this horizon, let's say, of conflict, suggesting, of course, that it is in the midst of those collisions where architectural practice should reposition itself, redefining its procedures. And for me, it was an amazing treat because you can imagine just a few couple of months before the Bush administration packed its bags, I was able to, you know, have this opportunity to hang the most intensive border in the world as the entrance to the U.S. pavilion, and to become literally a threshold to search for other practices that were exhibited inside the pavilion that were equally attempting to redefine themselves in order to make sense of this crisis. The conditions that have produced the crisis become the material for design. This was part of the notion. And of course, the suggestion in my own practice that this border territory, this very small area, is where we find compressed some of the most intensive conditions that are redefining our ideas of urbanization. The politics of immigration, of migration, the interrelated politics of migration, cheap labor and surveillance, again, the tensions between formal and informal urbanisms, of density and sprawl, and finally, probably no other place in the world is where you would find some of the wealthiest real estate, as the one found in the edges of San Diego, barely 20 minutes away from some of the poorest settlements in Latin America. So this radical proximity of wealth and poverty really begins to suggest this as a laboratory for my own practice, moving from that regional border into the projects on both sides of the border where I've been experimenting. So these transborder suburbias, and my practice has moved from the strategies of the informal in Tijuana into the politics of discriminating zoning in San Diego. So many flows have been of interest throughout my practice. One, of course, people going north, immigrants in search for dollars, and waste going south as Tijuana recycles the waste of San Diego to build its new periphery. And many times I always show this because it's a very dramatic way of beginning this conversation. The houses that are recycled from Tijuana, by Tijuana from San Diego, that are taken from the first ring of urbanization that has begun to dismantle. And these houses cross the border and put on top of these moment frames, leaving the space beneath open-ended for more house or a small business. This sort of layering of programs, which is very inspirational to witness. Of course, the waste that is recycled, like tires, you've seen this in the past, but now look at what they are doing. People in conditions of social emergency, they are able to dismantle this tire, loop it, clip it to create a more functional retaining wall. So these, again, conditions of emergency always provoke people to figure out ways, inventive ways of operating. Of course, the pallet racks to constructing habitation, et cetera. Probably the most famous one, the garage doors that are imported from Riverside in San Diego to construct housing in the edges of Tijuana again. So this very dramatic idea that the Levittown of San Diego, of Southern California, the post-war subdivisions, have begun to dismantle in the last 30, 40 years, and their debris is actually being transferred 20 minutes south to construct the new periphery or the new suburbs of Tijuana. This idea that Levittown is recycled into Tijuana's slums is incredibly dramatic to witness. And finally, from here, the recognition of a conflict that emerges out of those procedures as factories in Tijuana, maquiladoras they are called, begin to borrow labor from those shanty towns that recycle these materials in order to produce their products. And we have been engaging one of these maquiladoras, in fact, to speak of the conflict between labor, emergency housing, and sort of this emergency urbanism. And we have negotiated the production of these frames out of this maquiladora, this factory from Spain called Mecalux, a frame that can be used as a kind of scaffold, let's say, for a moment, a hinge that can help to stitch this waste in more coherent ways, because you can imagine the first rainy season, all this fragile architecture housing is washed away. So the idea was to plug a very minimal gesture to allow a levels of structural rigidity to allow also a coherent way of wasting, of stitching, let's say, this housing urbanism made of waste.
Well, as Teddy mentioned, the architecture elements that are crossing the border, there's another kind of trafficking that currently happens between Mexico and U.S. border, which is obviously from Mexico, the export of drugs and the import of weapons from. So Daily, there are 2,000 weapons that are brought from the United States into Mexico. And obviously, this is because, I mean, there's no production of weapons in Mexico, but it is very easy to buy weapons in the United States and smuggle them into Mexico. So actually, it's very easy that the army and the police is overpowered by the cartels, which can get hold of high power weapons that are strictly for the use of the army. And once I was invited to make an art project at a botanical garden where a patron which was interested in creating a sculpture garden, and many are, you know, like a major artist like Dan Graham or James Turrell or Olafur Eliasson and Franz West, etc., were made contributions to this garden. But going back to the to the idea of pushing the institutional invitation into becoming an agent of transformation, the proposal I made was to call for a campaign to collect weapons that were voluntarily donated by the public, by the population, and the collector, who happens to be a owner of a supermarket chain, released coupons, so everyone willing to donate a weapon would receive in exchange a coupon that could be traded for a microwave or a fridge or a computer. So it consisted first on a series of TV spots. I'm going to show one of them, where these are not artwork of mine. This is done by the local TV.
Le encontré a mi hijo una pistola escondida en su cuarto. Yo no quiero que mi hijo sea un asesino. Aquí vengo a donarla. Un arma en casa es un peligro.
So, one of the elements that I wanted to address was that they're kind of like a soap opera style, you can see. But their attempt is to kind of model behavior. So someone to kind of activate a mechanism at the core of a family, no, where, you know, like a wife or a mother kind of wants to give this idea to her husband or her son, and, you know, like get this kind of collaboration between private enterprise, local government, and civic society. And the...
A mi marido no le va a gustar nada, pero ya me harté de que nomás se toma unos tragos y le da por sacar la pistola delante de nuestros hijos. Aquí vengo, señor, a donar esta arma.
Un arma en casa es un peligro.
So, there is also a cultural element that is, you know, like a maybe if I ask how many of you have consumed an illegal drug, I don't know what would be the percentage of people, maybe 30, 40, 50%. But if we were to ask how many of you have actually killed someone with a gun, I doubt that there would be like a maybe just one single person who would qualify for that. But, you know, like the kind of a perception of a, you know, like politically correct country like Sweden or, you know, like Canada, that are major arm producers, is very different to those who are the drug producers. And the harm that an arm...
Los niños estaban jugando. De repente Luisito sacó una pistola que tenía su papá en el buró y... Dios mío, por...
It's very radically different, no? Like, so, these are images of the weapons that were collected. On this first event, 1,500 weapons were gathered, and later took into a military zone. And it was interesting to work. Probably as an artist, one has a stereotype kind of a reaction against the army at first. And it was very, very striking to see how vulnerable they were against the forces of the cartels. One of the nice things about this project has been that after this recollection where these guns were collected, they were later took into a... Once they were destroyed, they were took into a foundry. So the metal, which was gathered, was then made into 1,500 shovels in order to plant 1,500 trees. So I went to another art collector whose owns the second largest producer of shovels in the world. And it's a curious relationship because often collectors are only, clients who buy a finished work, and in this kind of project it was interesting to have another kind of partnership where they, as in Marxist terms, as owners of the means of production, were actually getting involved in the production of the artwork. So the idea was that they were like something like getting active in the process itself. And now this project, it's on preparation for at the core of the idea is also replicability. You know, how can you create a model that is repeated? So now there are on new three cities which will make the same exercise of collecting the weapons and make a second run of shovels. And there is certain degree of effectivity of, you know, like putting out an agent of death and turning that into an agent of life, which are the shovels by the planting of the trees. But the most important element is to create a story that circulates. So as the fact that this was an artwork really has no relevance, because the people that got involved into this process, it doesn't add anything to the story if it comes out from the art world. And this is the currency of an action that has to have, that this kind of action has to have in order to create a myth that can travel to different cultural environments. So, so basically it is a kind of this alchemical process of transforming matter, no? Like what is something that, as these shovels are now given to public schools, the kids, which kind of on their way to the school, see the newspapers of the kind of killings and crimes from the cartels. The fact of taking part on this ritual of planting a tree with a shovel that was formerly a weapon has some kind of pedagogical element that is what is like that unit of content that is what this project looks after. Maybe we should switch to you.
You know, I'm realizing that, of course, we're rushing through the work, but this issue of the redefinition, let's say, of the role of the architect or the artist, in this case, I guess we found this sort of common thread in the context of, let's say, the project in Tijuana, as I've been witnessing and documenting this flow of waste from one city to another. And of course, the construction of this informal urbanization in the shape of slums and shantytowns is not only the image of the informal that has been captivating, but in fact, the procedures, the political economy of waste, as it has been really producing a kind of level of sustainability for some of these communities. So the role of the artist as an interlocutor, as an agent that begins to produce a series of cross-institutional and agency collaborations, as we have, instead of going to the shantytown, we went to the factory, let's say, to push them to be accountable, since they are borrowing labor from these environments, to really give something back in the shape of this micro-infrastructure. So I think that that reminds me, because that's a key element of the story. But nevertheless, as flow of waste is going southbound, the other direction for me is an important one as people go north, and probably the one that inspires my work the most in San Diego, California, which is really the impact of immigrants in the reshaping of the American city, or particularly of the American neighborhood. So I've been in this show that we were together, I included three small videos, which we've been collecting stories, anecdotes, as immigrants and other, let's say, demographics have begun to retrofit the wasteful or a kind of selfish urbanization of California into a more complex systems of social and economic contingencies. And so one of them, of course, is the about the land use between these two cities. I mean, imagine the most trafficked border in the world and not one single transborder land use map exists. So I had to splice them almost intuitively. I've been trying to produce very naive images so that I can really use them as tools to converse with politicians and community activists. So if we were to, for a moment, splice these two conditions of land use, in San Diego, the large size of these large swatches of zoning, let's say, versus the high pixelation of this three-dimensional zoning in Tijuana. And I began to notice that it also, as the Levittowns have begun to dismantle themselves and their debris have built a new periphery of Tijuana, also those Levittowns have begun to be pixelated as this high sort of fine-grained land use condition begins to contaminate the large size of this zoning in San Diego, and the positing itself in very particular neighborhoods. As our interest has been, of course, downtowns, the redevelopment of downtown out of a very wealthy project of gentrification, luxury condos, Steria, and the franchises that surround them, and the periphery, the suburbs that equally now are framed with very wealthy project of infrastructure, and we continue to ignore, of course, the first ring of suburbanization, at least in the American city, is here where many of these immigrants have settled themselves, unable to afford the high rents of downtown, of course, and the high real estate of the periphery, and conveniently serving as a service sector that feeds with cheap labor these two environments. So part of the issue here is the relationship of the politics of labor, immigration, of course, and urbanization. So if we imagine that those Levittowns look like this, very homogeneous fabrics, they also, in the last 30, 40 years, have begun to transform dramatically out of informal economies and informal densities, or non-conforming patterns of urbanization, as the municipality calls them, including the non-conforming Buddha, that in fact has transformed this post-war little bungalow into a Buddhist temple in one of these neighborhoods, and in so doing has transformed a unit of dwelling, as we measured it institutionally, into an agency, as this Buddhist temple now negotiates socioeconomic possibilities of exchange, let's say, in the neighborhood, equally investing in pedagogy and cultural projects. So as this first ring of suburbanization has transformed fundamentally, what will happen to the second, third, fourth, fifth ring of suburbanization at this moment? Could it be that in the next 60 years, these Mac mansions in the periphery of San Diego will transform as well? The other story had to do also with this idea of encroachment. Part of it, many times I define my practice as a practice of encroachment, not only across boundaries in terms of property, but also in terms of institutional encroachment. So another aspect that has been important to notice is the use of the leftover space in this highly wasteful urbanization of Southern California. So I did another naive drawing, if I can call it that, just eliminating the city from San Diego and just leaving all the empty spaces, this compendium of voids, where I think the informal can cite itself. But also I documented not only the physicality of these spaces, but the many kind of a stupid planning in a way, the wasteful jurisdictional pieces that are really defining an amazing amount of leftover spaces as well in San Diego. The most paradigmatic one, I'm sure for you here in London, does not exist, but it's called paper streets. It's a definition in the code in California, paper street, which is a street that was at one point designed in the planning department of downtown San Diego or Los Angeles as the planners constructed this abstract grid. But when they took that grid to the reality of the topography, they found out that they couldn't build that street because of a topographic condition that would make it very expensive. So they never built it. So it's called paper street. It's a chunk of public realm that is ignored, that is invisible. And so I began to notice that these leftover spaces were surrounded by other conditions that could mobilize possibilities. So we were looking at that leftover space that is on the top there, a triangular piece, and instead of just seeing it as a unit, we began to pair it with other leftover conditions, and we realized that leftover space was surrounded by a factory that was close to the neighborhood. We went to knock on the door. Turned out that it was one of the most famous skateboard companies in the world in that neighborhood. In front of it, there was a paper street. Next to the vacant lot, there was a dead-end sort of alley that could be activated. One block away, an elementary school. All of these agencies had budgets, had programs that were being ignored. They couldn't recognize each other. So part of the project was the triangulation across these agencies, these schools, these pedagogies, these programs, to frame those empty spaces, those vacant spaces with possibility in terms of programmatic temporalities, let's say. And so look at this. This is a paper freeway, a freeway that was never built. And you can see the informal trails. But these are equally surrounded by agencies, community-based nonprofit organizations, schools, and so on. So a lot of our projects in these conditions have been to pair and to bring together some of these possibilities. The story has to do primarily with this series of leftover spaces very quickly next to a freeway in the neighborhood where I live, as I began to interview a series of teenagers who invaded one night a few years ago, this underpass in the freeway. They decided that because they didn't have any place to really skateboard freely, that they would, in fact, go to Home Depot and get some shovels. Mm-hmm. And one night, I mean, I've been interviewing them, and I have a video of that. They decided to invade this leftover space under this freeway, and they began to excavate, to construct their ramps. 2 weeks later, they were stopped by the police, and the whole place was barricaded. They had to organize, they told me, and I've been documenting this, as I'm mentioning. The first thing that these teenagers did was to recognize the political jurisdiction inscribed in that invisible leftover space. They told me that they had been lucky because they hadn't begun to dig in the state territory, meaning the freeway, Caltrans, which is the institution or agency that governs the freeway. They had been lucky because they dug in an arm of the freeway that belonged to the city. They were also lucky because they had begun to dig in a kind of Bermuda Triangle of jurisdiction, because it was between Port Authority, Airport Authority, two city districts, a review board that belonged to the Pacific Coast Highway. And so they, as teenagers, they were telling me what my students of architecture would never know about. They recognized the political power inscribed in that territory, and therefore they now continue to understand who were the faces behind that political power. They contacted city officials. They had to recognize who the city attorney was and who the city council members were. They were advised to become an NGO. They had to create bylaws. They had to confer with other skateboarders in Northern California who had gone through similar experience. They had to get an insurance. They began to fundraise. They had to produce ways of capitalizing on hidden budgets from parks and recreation and other areas. In other words, they had to recognize also the economic power inscribed behind the fragmentation of these stupid institutions that do not really collaborate with each other. And finally, they won the case, and they were able to make their skateboard park under that freeway becoming, after transferring liability, they were able to lease this space for 1 cent a year. I mean, there are so many aspects of the story that would be great to tell, but I'm quickly just will finish with the last story, which has to do with the series of tunnels that have begun to, that were dug after 9/11 across the border. 40 tunnels in total have been dug beneath Homeland Security in the last years. And all of them are accompanied by amazing anecdotes, officially described by Homeland Security, all of them different sizes for different purposes and so on. But they began to pixelate again and transgress this formidable barrier, creating this 70-foot underground urbanism. Ironically, the only places of connection between Tijuana and San Diego. The last tunnel, of course, this suggests the informal economies and densities that are invisible to the institutions that could be really acknowledged. These tunnels connect parking lots with houses, churches, with factories on both sides of the border. The last tunnel, as I was mentioning, was found 2 years ago. It was really large, very, very fantastic. Had retaining walls, electricity, water extraction systems, ventilation. And when the cartel people who commissioned the tunnel would not use it, they would lease it to coyotes crossing people across the border. So I many times joke this became the first mixed-use tunnel across the border. But of course, not to sensationalize this, but it's really to suggest that the informal has a play, has a role in redefining our idea of urbanization. And the first tunnel, which is this house, was dug to connect the house to a parking lot. But again, this happening beneath Homeland Security, who has been proud to convey to the American public, these are actual pages from the Homeland Security website, of the matrix of militarization that has been installed in the border, including the border calculus. I'm telling you, the military has more sophisticated urban strategies and architectural schools, including the mini Fallujahs, the kind of mini villages, Iraqi villages, mock villages that are constructed in these military bases around San Diego, where soldiers train. Amazing technology where they actually project holograms of Arab subjects moving through this environment. So this really relentless sort of top-down sort of systems of control by the military are being counterbalanced by these tactics of encroachment or of transgression. It's been very interesting to witness.
So another piece in the show was this set of tables that was called Ideas for Iraq, which somehow played on this current conflict and attempted to address the occupation with a different educational tool. No, the games have always been present have an element of military strategy, from chess to video games, and the military, an occupation or a combat is often planned with this kind of more like a scale model of where different actors are in place. So this piece, which was in the show, was kind of a set of tables with Iraq and its neighboring countries, and a library of symbols that represented the different ethnic groups and forces and civilians and events that were recognizable. So the San Francisco Art Institute were kind to invite Iraqi veterans together with political analysts and they played this game as a kind of a informal game where as they were playing, they were inventing their own rules. And both Teddy and I also contributed in order to somehow use this as a kind of rehearsal of how can this current conflict can be visualized. Because although it's mainly a US-led occupation, it's not foreign to both Guatemala and Mexico. The first soldier that was killed in the conflict was from Guatemala, and many Mexicans living in California and the rest of the states in the United States are enrolling, hoping to get citizenship, which not always happens. But there is a very important population of people from Latin America that are immigrants into the United States that are part of the armed forces. So the way it works is that it's the exchanges from the different experts are recorded. This was another edition of the same seminar in Reykjavik, were also people who were part of the Red Cross, together with people that were from NATO, and representatives of the of Muslim and community, also together with NGO organizations to against military bases, participated also in this edition of the seminar in Reykjavik. And the way it works is that it's basically a moving seminar that every institution, now it's going to Chicago, where which holds this project, invites whatever is available as a kind of a local knowledge regarding the project in order to adopt some content. There's like also like speech bubbles that help to do you know, like to take notes of whatever of the kind of commentaries, and this is a little bit like based on the work of Alvin Palmstrom, an artist who also was dealing with maps, and this three-dimensional version of a comic strip was also part of the idea of conflict resolution in the exhibition.
And of course, many of these ideas in my practice have been essential in order to problematize not only our reductive notions of the global and the local dialectics, but also between the top-down and the bottom-up dynamics. I mean, many times a lot of my friends call me the bottom-up guy, you know, which in fact does not make sense. I mean, I think that we need to really understand the kind of ways of negotiating across those scales. And one aspect is, of course, the modes or the modalities of representation in the city. That my experience in these neighborhoods, this first ring of suburbanization, older neighborhoods where immigrants have been settling, they have become a laboratory for my practice in redefining particular institutional cliches. I mean, density continues to be defined in a very abstract, reductive way across institutions. An amount of units per acre or an amount of people per acre, part of what I've been interested in my experience is to really challenge, in fact, this reductive abstraction and to suggest that in many of these neighborhoods, density could be, like that Buddhist temple, be translated into an amount of socioeconomic exchanges per acre. I mean, what kind of drawing or what kind of map would that generate? But also it allows us to redefine, of course, at this very moment, our notions of ownership and property. I mean, if you really think about it, the crisis, economic crisis, began in the United States precisely because people who could not pay loans, repay loans, you know, were given these loans. So in conditions of marginality and poverty, the American dream collapsed, many times I say. So we need to rethink property in other kinds of modalities. And so I was commissioned by the Museum of Modern Art to in New York to really produce this piece called McMansion Retrofitted, in suggesting this playful conceptual sort of idea of how this selfish, oil-hungry urbanization of Southern California would be pixelated again with small conditions of property. Of course, it's inspired by the famous image of Arki Zoom, the non-stop city, because this is non-stop sprawl, and it's not going to stop anytime soon. And the idea that the future of urbanization in California will be, in fact, defined by this pixelation of the large with the small, but is not only, again, the informal condition, as this large 9,000 square feet, 900 square meter big McMansions will be transformed into 2-3 units in a small business, because that's already happening. Because of the economic crisis, owners of these houses are leasing these houses to small families and so on. So it's not the image, again, of the informal in terms of these alterations, but really, as I'm saying, the pixelation of ownership, as these large parcels would have to really be altered, and other ideas of collaboration across property would exist. So this transformation of the Big Mac Mansion into a village has been a kind of paradigm of our practice. And of course, in so doing, redefining sustainability as we continue also in a very reductive way, think of sustainability as just a process of camouflaging this selfish urbanization, as we just simply, you know, install this high technology of photovoltaic panels without challenging or without questioning the size of this selfish urbanization, the politics and economics that really have been supporting this urbanism on steroids. And in so doing, redefining housing. So much of our projects in many of these neighborhoods have begun by the statement and the question that my client, a community activist in this neighborhood of San Isidro at the border, said to me, no advances in housing design can be achieved without advances in housing policy and in housing lending and subsidy. This was 5, 6, 7 years ago when she was telling me this. So we designed micro policies in these neighborhoods. It's too long a story to tell. Finding a new role for these nonprofit organizations based on these neighborhoods as they are transforming into micro developers of housing. And in so doing, suggesting that housing cannot just be perpetuated as units spread in the territory, but they need to be plugged with support systems, social, cultural, economic support systems, micro-infrastructures of sorts. So the projects that we have been doing are really transforming small parcels into complex sort of micro-social systems, if I can call it that, frames, gardens, the alteration of existing buildings to become a kind of infrastructure at a smaller scale that can be plugged with a diversity of economic performance as people and their sweat equity, as dwellers in these communities participate, and so on. So the transformation of our notions of affordability and so on. So this simply the idea that these housing projects in conditions of poverty need to be inserted into an infrastructure of a social service and cultural and pedagogical mobility. That has been the paradigm somehow of the practice. And of course, how do we call these small infrastructures? You know, we at some point, because we needed money to pay for them, because banks do not fund infrastructure, we call them public art, probably. And then we can just install the housing project on top of them. This sort of idea that for each unit that we build in this housing in these neighborhoods, there is the same amount of square footage dedicated to an infrastructure that could be injected with very specific programming by nonprofit organizations. So it's not about ambiguity for ambiguity's sake, but as I call it, it's a specific ambiguity in a sense. So that relationship has been essential as well.
So not going, switching from the border to the context of Mexico City, I've been also working with the local government in terms of addressing some of the, well, playing again with what can the museum do to activate its environment. So working with the Museo de la Ciudad de México, which is not an art museum, but what we could call a contemporary culture museum focused on urban, of the history of urbanism, I was invited to do a project where I proposed to create a man-powered vehicle that could provide service in downtown. And this vehicle is not only designed for you know, like a, making a small fleet, but also the museum is a kind of becomes an assembly line where there's people who are in technical school that come to work at the museum, and by helping to do this vehicle, they get kind of a small course on bicycle science, so they can then learn how to assemble and repair bicycles. So instead of making the museum a recipient for a finished work, it becomes a producer, which is a mix of a factory and a school. And this is a project that is in preparation after the making of this prototype. So starting with that project, I continue to work with the local government on a project that is currently under developing. Because next year, we're celebrating the 100 years of revolution and 200 years of independence. And I approached the government with the idea of curating a show. And at first, the idea was to do a great, you know, like a big show on sustainability, somehow like Bruce Mao Massive Change or this kind of exhibitions. But it became evident that the idea of a mega show that were centralized was not as interesting as creating a new kind of exhibition that could go to those places that don't have any cultural offer or cultural, how do you say, offer? Like instead, I changed the idea to create an atlas of all those initiatives and groups that are working in the city either on environmental issues or education, health, culture, economy, security, social justice, democracy, etc. So this is a box that contains 100 posters. Each of these posters shows an isometric view of a crossroad where, in a, as a kind of infogram, the dynamics of this initiative is displayed, and you know, like you see what is like a kind of a abstract representation of the kind of elements of this group, what are the actors, what is the activities they do, and the group of these 100 posters can be assembled in a mural where you come up with a view of a city which is not like a kind of accurate in terms of its geography, but it's a puzzle that together becomes this mural. So you can take all the posters out of this box and create this wall diagram. And in the back of each of these posters, you have interviews with the leaders of this initiative, which have both the statement of what are the motivations, how do they start it, what do they do, together with some expert that gives a different angle. And each of these groups are asked to come up with a recipe or a instruction. So whatever they do, for instance, in this case, this is a group that does urban agriculture, they cannot explain how to do a full, you know, like a agriculture parcel, but they can go into a particular unit that perhaps is just an explanation of how to prepare compost. So the way it works is that for next year, well, in September we're releasing the 10 first posters, and then by next year we'll complete the box, which will contain these 100 posters, and the print run will be 50,000 boxes. So in the city there are 30,000 public schools. Each of them will receive this box, and each of them is requested to do to set up the exhibition. And out of these 100 posters, they have to choose 30 where they carry out the recipe. So you have like some kind of exhibition, a little bit like a science fair, where you have all these recipes. Some of them are actual experiments or activities or you know, like a group activities. And the results of each of these recipes, you know, like how these activities are carried out, must be uploaded into a Web 2.0 platform. So you see how these thousands of small exhibitions have interpreted this score, no? This you know, like this instruction. So in the end, instead of doing one single show, we're going to have thousands of small shows that all convey into this internet platform. So this is like the idea of, again, like doing a different pedagogical platform that doesn't rely on, you know, like having the spectator going through this exhibition as a passive element, but trying to engage the students into an element where they all again became producers of the work.
Thank you so much. A tremendous amount of food for thought there, from paper streets to urban alchemy to urban pixelation. I just wanted to situate your work. I understand that your show in San Francisco took place just before the crash last year. And I know certainly from experience here in the UK, for example, at The Architecture Foundation in April ran a series of seminars about repositioning spatial practice during crisis. And certainly during those discussions and also in the press here, it's very clear that there's a real appetite amongst built environment professionals and indeed a broader public for the sorts of models of resourcefulness that are so apparent in the work that you've done observing these systems in the global south of these systems of, I think Teddy used the word, of social emergency, and a real, again, an appetite for a shift from the past years of glorification of individualism to looking more at models of collective action, et cetera. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more, both of you, about how your work, if it is evolving, how if you felt that there's a more eager audience for your work, perhaps, outside of the initial conditions in which it was spawned.
Great. No, in reality, I mean, it's funny because many people, friends, and you know, ask me, so what has happened in your office, you know, in this condition of crisis? So, well, we've always been in crisis in the office, you know. And of course, not only that, but I've been arguing already for a few years that it is, in fact, within communities. I'm glad that you arrived to these models of citizenship and the kind of idea that neighborhoods can be co-producers or producers of their own economies and their own markets, let's say, for a moment, that new models of affordability, of economy, sustainability, economically and socially, can emerge from within communities. And in that sense, I think that part of what has been of inspiration at this moment is to take a detour for a moment, not only in the opportunity that is presented in front of us, that the crisis always presents us with an opportunity to redefine the way of thinking and redefine the institutions, but in our case, now, even in some of the projects that we are doing, for example, in Nicaragua, where instead of arriving to housing right away, we had to produce the economic base for this particular poor village to have the instruments to really to produce the housing themselves. But the in essence, very quickly, it has to do with we are shifting our gaze. I mean, forced by this bubble bursting, that in the last years, our profession of architecture had been so infatuated with the centers of power economically, supported by this, again, relentless idea of neoliberalism as a kind of bastion of a free market, of deregulation, and ultimately of illegality, while in fact we continue to blind ourselves against the possibility that within the informal in some of these communities, that very idea could really have been an empowering tool. Because as we were discussing this morning, I've been working with informal markets in some of these neighborhoods. At least here in Europe, they are over-regulated and they are really restricted because of immigrants and so on. And not only that, but as we open up the potentialities, let's say, offered by these bottom-up economies, we need to also inject them with social agency. So it's not just about economy for economy's sake, but really about systems of monitoring to prevent socioeconomic injustice as well. But this notion, again, of citizenship, I think, as injected in our profession of a certain sense of ethics, now allows probably to really reorient ourselves not to focus on the size of abundance, but size of scarcity from which ideas can be harvested to redefine, again, our own institutions of densification or of development and so on. That's I think, what is nice about you ending with that project, because mm-hmm. it suggests that idea of collaboration with communities.
Yes, and I think that somehow, like the way that architecture practice was linked to real estate, art practice was linked to the art market, no? In a bit that there has been certainly like a kind of slowdown in both fields, but that practice that is related to research and to kind of social enterprise, now it's having a momentum, which is very interesting, and the practice is changing, you know, like in the way that probably you find yourself working for other, you know, like in a different economy. Mm-hmm. And this is really interesting, because it's addressing precisely these issues which suddenly becomes urgent. No?
Mm-hmm. You know, if I can just mention, I mean, as we because again, I hadn't seen the last work, and as we have arrived, let's say, to the scale of the neighborhood, mm-hmm. to really understand who is the audience, who are the stakeholders, who are the faces behind these communities and these, in these invisible transactions in these neighborhoods, there is an amazing opportunity. I think that I begin to realize also that our role in not only opening up this conversation with communities and ourselves across disciplines is one of translators of some of those dynamics, in a sense. And in that context, I've been interested in Latin America as a site that has not been noticed, precisely because Dubai and China were the places for architectural intervention. But in fact, the most advanced, the most progressive ideas of infrastructure and of negotiating bottom-up and top-down industry and social networks is really in Medellin, with progressive mayors like Sergio Fajardo in reinventing our idea of public space, or Enrique Peñalosa, of course, in Bogota, in Curitiba, and so on. Those projects continue to be talked about, but not in the way that they should. I think that we need to translate what really made them possible, what were the procedures, and in so doing, producing these recipes. I think this is part of what can be, these initiatives, as you call them, can be reinvested or reinjected somewhere else.
Can we talk about that a little more, actually, because I noticed before we open up to all of your questions, which I'm sure many of you will want to interject, there seems to me to be a slight tension between this ideal of replicability of interventions that so many of your projects seem to be focused on, that you start small, but I think there's quite a few saying that the individual action makes no difference. We need to find ways to multiply by 100, by 1,000, by 1,000,000. And then on the other hand, Teddy, some of your projects, thinking about the research you've done into very specific interventions like the skate park, which seem to be looking at very, very specific overlaying of political jurisdictions and particularities. I wondered if you could talk a bit more about if you see that as problematic, or if you can actually span between replicability and local specificity.
It's amazing. We haven't even had anything to drink. I'm getting excited now. This is a good question, because in reality, the skateboard park became an amazing model. And this is what really puts to rest many of my critics or friends, you know, who say, well, wait a minute, you know, what are you doing? You're exposing the informal? What about the magic of the insurgent, right? And I mean, by formalizing or creating institutions based on these dynamics, you are obliterating the possibility of this invisibility, which is always a very tricky thing. But okay, so what do? Do we just let it be? I mean, primarily at a time when we want to legitimize and uphold the fact that this economic sustainability can occur in the process of amplifying that. But we need mediating agencies. So this is where the nonprofits can really protect that insurgency, or how would we call it? Maybe that's not a good word, this invisibility, because we wouldn't want to expose these immigrants operating in the neighborhood. But what I'm trying to say is that the skateboard park became a very good model to suggest how an informal act of transgression can trickle up to transform a policy, to transform a very, you know, definition, the very reductive definition of public space or open space, which is, for us, is just putting green with a marker on a rectangle, right? And this marginal space became injected with this possibility. And of course, now that model is being able to be replicated, because we are now documenting what happened. So other teenagers in marginal neighborhoods in San Diego already know that that's possible. That it's empty spaces that are in their neighborhood, if they come together to organize themselves and to really recognize that they could replicate it, they can reproduce it. But again, it's this sort of negotiation between the kind of invisibility and allowing it to trickle up to produce new agency and institution, but without compromising its own autonomy at times. You know, without confusing everybody, what I'm trying to suggest is, how do we also produce the mediating agencies that can represent? It's an issue of the representation of some of these marginal communities. And nonprofits located in these neighborhoods really are taking that role.
I think that the ripple effect is also related not so much to the product, but to the modus operandi, in the way that you can choose to do hardware or to do software. No, like we live in an age where the future is pretty much defined by the programming of DNA and you know, like and software. So these are routines and subroutines that you run, and you can have them operating in different contexts. But what is interesting is to reveal what is this this code, no? So you know, like by writing code, you test something, and then it can be there can be different kind of input in mm-hmm. terms of information, but you know, like through that code, you have all different outcomes. So it's a different meditation to what was the art in the age of mechanical reproduction, because it's not repetition. Repetition is not the same to replicability.
Mm-mm,
you know, like it's not about a mass production of the same piece. It's about this software or this genetic code, or you know, like how do you have a process that certainly the products will be, the outcome will be different. No?
And I think it goes back to your idea of intervening within the institution to change the institution in an almost mm-hmm. viral manner so that it becomes an agent of change. We have about 15 minutes to open the floor to questions from the audience. If you could please wait for a microphone. We should have two roving mics from the back, and identify yourself before you ask your question. Anyone?
Hello, name's Indy Johar. Just a quick question. Some of the limits of communitarian logic, in a way, the informal is also a place for tyranny and feudalism and kind of power that operates in different ways. How do you deal with that? Because in a way, community value and public value don't necessarily coincide. And where's the limit of community value, and how does it really operate with public value? Because I think that's probably one of the big debates within the kind of, say, the global north, mm-hmm. of how we intersect with the kind of super diversity that we have kind of in the global north.
Precisely, and again, of course, there is no time to really go through the kind of fine grain explanation of some of the very interesting triangulations, at least that I've been investigating. And because, for example, at some point, somebody like Hernando de Soto, for example, was, when I first came across some of his theories, seemed incredibly empowering. This economist from Peru, for a lot of people like Mike Davis, who is a friend of mine, he told me one day, you know, Hernando de Soto is just another neoliberalist, you know, trying to suggest that an informal economy can in fact be amplified, can really be part of the official economy, which in a way is true, because the most incredible entrepreneurial energies are embedded in these shantytowns. But Mike told me, but without a kind of social project of producing the agencies that can mediate, in fact, those conditions of monopoly, of exploitation that also occur within this. So it's not about the glorification of the informal because, as a kind of, you know, only a kind of positive thing. There is that is also embedded in conditions of violence and so on. And so part of the issue, that's where I began to investigate, which is intuitively part of what I've been doing, that is not just arriving to the community with my kit of tools as an architect, but to enter into that space of conversation and collaboration with a social agency that has for decades been working in some of these neighborhoods. So how does one construct agency in that sense and allow these nonprofits, in my case in San Diego, to become informal city halls of sorts, and informal sort of producers of citizenship, loosely speaking, as they begin to see in those people who live in those neighborhoods not customers, but actual, you know, participants, actual citizens that where their sweat equity is transformed into economy, but also protected by these agencies. This is the issue, primarily in the United States. And we saw it how many of these communities were put in danger. People really were put in danger because they couldn't repay and there was nothing to protect them, no insurance. So the role of these agencies in allowing that social framework, let's say, of protection and collective participation is an important issue. And that, to me, by the way, I'm glad you mentioned it, is a design problem. I realized at some point, because I have not been interested in building that much, even though I'm passionate about architecture, but without building the political and economic processes that can be the fertile ground for more experimental architectures, I don't want to necessarily, you know, be interested in my own profession. So that we could design political process and economic process is an important issue within this notion of social justice. And that relationship, of course, is fundamental.
But also it throws up an interesting issue about the legitimacy of your practice, because practice, in a sense, and how you drive legitimacy in that process is a key issue. Because once you get driving into driving, designing political process, which I agree with you about, and we can talk about this later, but there is a kind of whole issue about legitimacy and where the role of the architect and practice and how we drive that, which I think is kind of a subtle but a key part of this conversation.
Yes.
Talking about the design process, I think that is not only having a number of options, but how about, but it is about, like, from those options, choosing the best one. And the relationship between producer and consumer is also something that, in another term, was addressed by Augusto Boal, who's a theater director from Brazil, who just died last month. And he would talk about it in different terms. He would coin the term spect actor, like a spectator that became an actor. And his method, which was called theater of the oppressed or forum theater, consisted basically on a play that was developed based on a local problem. Let's say a neighborhood where you have like a rape, let's say. And he would like choose a story, let's say, okay, that let's think about a woman who discovers that the rapist is his sobrino.
Nephew.
So she's faced with a conflict whether, telling the police or not. So it was about putting, you know, like not creating like an abstract policy, but bringing that down the conflict to the kind of real situation when someone has this kind of dilemma that is very difficult to address. So he would then stop the play at the moment where the protagonist is in the real, real moment to make a decision what to do. So they stop the play, and at that moment, they ask the audience to come up to the stage, put themselves in the place of the protagonist, and test one ending, and then a second ending, and then a third ending. Until you pretty much, after the fifth or sixth ending, you pretty much explored all the potential outcomes of the story. So that was creating social value, you know, like it's counterfactual thinking. That is, you know, like using a moment of collective awareness to explore your options, and from your options, choose the right one. They also created something called legislative theater, where out of these experiences, they would like pass on cards to the audience, for them to write what would they think it was like a law that could help or to prevent this kind of problem. So that was actually like a design process to make laws through this collective action. So I think this is an example of collective of social value.
No, it's interesting because I've been interested also and inspired by Bruno Latour's reassembling of the social notion of actor network theory, which, in fact, when working in localities, I mean, doesn't maybe apply to the global scale, but because where we rely on certain level of abstraction. But when you are working in a neighborhood, you need to know who the actors are and to understand their possible narratives and ways of sort of operating. And that suggests a series of associative models that are very unpredictable. But where, in fact, when you begin to understand who is the oppressor, who is the drug dealer, who is the community activist, how they are operating, that level of fine-grained resolution, I think, is necessary. And again, usually in architecture, we don't touch it because seemingly we are not social workers. But again, as Petreo said, we could be for a moment, to really understand those dynamics, and in so doing, amplify our role in terms of, you know, activation and recognition, basically, of those dynamics. So we wanted to ask some of you to come here, no, to, and tell us how the story ends.
Do we have any other questions?
Is this on? Yeah, hello. My name is Jaya. I come from an art background, but I'm studying urbanism at the London School of Economics at the moment. This might seem like a bit of a crude question after the previous one, but I was wondering, especially Teddy, how are you funded? Because I think when we're talking about economies and times of crises and radicalizing and politicizing practices, I think it's a very important question.
Well, like Zaha Hadid, my father is wealthy. No, I'm joking. basically, I teach, and I'm lucky to teach in an institution that supports research, so my office is embedded in the university, where I've convinced them to bring practice into artistic, you know, curriculum. And in so doing, they allow me to create a laboratory at the university where the practice is really based on research, and that my project, as long as my project was not commercial. And so I deal only with nonprofit organizations and foundations. Unless at some point, because of this crisis, some private owner or somebody with a lot of money comes in wanting to actually transform a sort of private endeavor into something that has public relevance.
The Murdoch chair of urbanism.
So anyway, but it's primarily because of my teaching and the support of institutions. And of course, in every project that I've been engaged in, which are not many, has been an arduous process of not only dealing with these issues that we talked about, but finding the agency to really, you know, produce certain levels of support across many granting agencies, foundations across the world, and so on. So it's a really arduous process of really harvesting some of this, you know, economic support. But primarily the merging, the hybrid of teaching, research, and practice, that is a device.
Pedro, when we were talking this morning, you mentioned you see your practice shifting out of the standard art market as well. Do you want to talk a bit more about that?
Yes, I think that this same, I find myself in a curious model also, because last year probably there was for contemporary art like a kind of high demand of commodities, no? Which were these kind of pieces that somehow fueled the art fairs and all the kind of art market model. So as this, but for instance, right now I find myself like more busy, which is curiously because, you know, like I am now directing a television series that I didn't talk about, but it's a kind of a 13 episode series about the economy, which is a puppet show made in collaboration between Japan and Mexico, and main protagonists are Karl Marx and Adam Smith. And so now I have three studios. One is this production company, which is which, you know, like a, it's like a kind of a machine in the media environment, which is like television. Then there is like this government project where I have like a kind of another studio with another team of people, and my art studio. So I have to run between three offices, and it's very curious because now I have two steady incomes and one that is very small, that is, you know, like the art, standard art practice. But it's like it has shifted to a different context where your client is a government, or your client is another market, which is not the art market. So I think that it's just like this idea of currency, of how can your practice have some relevance in a different cultural environment.
If I can maybe quickly add to that, which might sound counterintuitive at this very moment, but I live in San Diego, and that's where I work and live and teach. And for some reason in the United States, San Diego has become a kind of stronghold of architects becoming developers and not really waiting for the client. And we have been collaborating with a group of friends at some point we realize that our work, our fees, are sweat equity in a sense, or are collateral for a particular loans, and so that already produce a percentage of money that could be really put on the table in terms of a kind of particular loan bracket. And if we talk about certain categories such as owner-occupied, I mean, it's interesting to imagine that some of the most beautiful parts of Los Angeles in the 20s were made of duplexes and fourplexes, precisely because an economy was supporting entrepreneurial efforts like this, where a duplex was for somebody to be to sustain a mortgage. So sometimes when we talk about how the political and the economic really is a framework to produce particular architectures, we forget that those models existed when somehow our values were different. So I think that to do small projects with friends, collaborate and becoming developers where the pro forma is the site of intervention is a very empowering thing, of course. And now if you know the kind of hidden agendas of the municipality where there are certain hidden budgets, that if you do the project, a relevant project in terms of pedagogy or community engagement, you can also get subsidies and so on. So the kind of jerry-rigging of the economic frameworks by architects becomes an empowering tool. I'm suggesting that could be another way, not waiting for clients or developers, but really rallying your friends and to suggest that already your fees are collateral. That was an amazing kind of discovery for myself.
I think we'll take one more question from the audience, and then you've given such a tantalizing preview. I think it might be nice to share with the audience a small clip from your next project. I think, can we have done the first?
Oh, there was
please?
A question here.
Yeah.
Thank you, first of all, both of you, for a really exciting, interesting discussion. I'm an engineer, so for me this is quite an unusual kind of discussion. I have two questions. One is less precise than the other. If 20 years ago architects were taking boats and ships and then moving them to buildings and calling it architecture, and 10 years ago it was software, how do we avoid this exciting new kind of model becoming fashion and style and being just transported? Because one of the things I've noticed, I mean, there are other models like this, the night work that goes on in Palestine or the work that Muhammad Yunus has done in Bangladesh, which is doing banking, which are similar things, but they've bettered the world much more than what we did 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. So how do we protect ourselves from avoiding that as a dilemma? And a second question, which is very precise about architecture, what is your view on beauty in architecture? Because that was one of the kind of disappointments in some of the work that I saw.
The work in terms of
the architectural piece.
The examples in Tijuana.
Well, the frames from Spain
frames
were pretty ugly.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, heavy question. So do we have 30 more minutes? Yes. Okay. basically, the first one is not to be afraid that it will become co-opted by particular institutions that want to package this, but maybe to really be precise, even more precise. We are all empowered by the possibility of micro-lending, but micro-lending has been already exhausted and impacted and really becoming another tool of exploitation. But micro-lending can become specific when we know the exact programming, and this is part of the project in Nicaragua that we are doing, is rethinking the micro-lending as the community becomes co-owner of the resources and so on. I mean, it's giving more fine grain sort of elaboration, let's say, to some of these projects. At the same time, I think that, again, it's a risk that is worth taking. I'm very, very critical of this politics of style. When things become co-opted by the kind of project of beautification, and we don't understand what are the procedures behind. Somebody, I think Stan Allen, an architect theorist, said that we have been preoccupied just by the way things look, not by what they do, I mean, what buildings do. And so to understand the procedures and to really articulate them intelligently, that's part of the challenge. Not to, all of a sudden, because something becomes fashionable, we're going to throw it away. I think the issue is to edit that material, because every history is important. We can harvest from it surgically the best things, the best practices that can be taken to other levels. So I think more accuracy. The issue of beauty is that the frames are just supporting something that unavoidably is happening. The recycling and the slums are happening. I'm not going to pretend to hide that, but to just support and inject into those environments systems that can really allow that to be taken to other levels. So it's about a transitional architecture. The problem in the beginning is as ugly as it can be, because that's what these environments are about. I mean, this is, which I would challenge you and just say they are incredibly beautiful. They are a lot more beautiful in the sense that many other environments, because if anything, there is a ton of threading of material and a kind of gentle way of relating to the topography and so on. But I want to abstract that. I don't want to glorify also poverty. I want to abstract that, translate it into models, into recipes. But ultimately, what I'm trying to say is that the reason we continue to be in trouble in terms of our profession is that we have just polarized ourselves from those realities by just being invested in a hyper project of formalism and hyper aesthetics. And we're not understanding that the cities are mutating, that these immigrants are transforming these cities in fundamental ways, and that behind that ugliness, there is a procedure that can really allow us to transform precisely this condition of crisis at this very moment, if we translate them. It's not about building those ugly environments in London, but to suggest that there is an intelligence on the ground that we could capitalize on. It's beyond beauty. It's about mobilizing resources and so on. If there was time for just finish with that, could be fine. I don't know if there is another. I don't know if you wanted to add to the comment or to the question, but or maybe there's. No.
Maybe if you want to show your current
just, project. Just it might be nice to end actually with your two current we projects, could. A little bit about Nicaragua and then a bit from the film project.
A suggestion okay. was that we could just end with two impressions of the work that is happening at this moment from where we left it, because as we are given the opportunity by institutions like the Tate at this moment and the Architecture Foundation to re-encounter ourselves, I think that we continue, of course, to learn from each other, and there are projects that are unfolding as we speak. So you want to show, or do you want me to begin, you finish with the puppet show?
Well, maybe I can show, and then you, or what? How do you like?
I think it would be great to finish with the puppet
yeah,
show.
Yeah, okay, so I agree. Let's do Nicaragua.
I will just
hard act to follow that.
Just, I think that maybe we can lower the lights. We will not take you. I mean, it's a record time. I think we crammed a lot of information. Anyway, five more minutes. No, 5 minutes. This idea again of understanding sites of scarcity as the probable laboratories to rethink some of these issues that we've been talking about took me to a project in Nicaragua that began by an opportunity given by Harvard University, as they invited me to teach a studio. And I brought together a nonprofit organization from Spain called Casas de la Esperanza and a foundation from New York City called Park Foundation. And I kind of assembled a kind of process of collaboration to arrive to this community in the margins of this colonial city called Granada outside Managua, Nicaragua. And again, working with this notion that housing can become an economic engine for communities, not just shelter in conditions of emergency, but really truly a way of redefining the role of these communities in producing their own systems of inhabitation. So the places between Granada, which is this colonial city, which is impacted by global tourism, and the lake that is incrementally being privatized by American and Canadian developers. And in the middle, there is this road made of dirt, where we find the community of La Prusia. So we came to this typical issue of circles of poverty surrounding enclaves of wealth, in a sense, or of gentrification, because these are the people that service these centers with cheap labor. So this is the road. So this is what I was saying, taking a detour. We found out out of this Harvard studio that we were not going to go to housing right away, but that we were going to fix this road, and that this road was an opportunity for the community to become a building industry if we were found a way to produce the tools. And so the building of this infrastructure would be the device for housing. So we produce a system of collaboration between these institutions, as I was mentioning, including the Intelligent Systems, which is this company owned by a friend of mine at the border, where we are trying to produce these prefabricated systems to produce trusses that are manually assembled that don't need welding, and that other entities would really come into assistance, such as Engineers Without Borders, even the municipality of Granada that had funding to fix the road, but they didn't have enough and didn't have the machines. And that was what really would be the system of collaboration to engage the community of La Prusia. And after many of the workshops that we engaged with them, I can never forget when one of the members of the community said, you know, don't give us shelter only, give us the tools to make the blocks, give us jobs. And that, of course, suggests that this is obvious. I mean, this is what we've been talking about perennially, but we continue just to dump technology and money on these communities without understanding that we need to design the systems within which some of these assistance can be meaningful culturally. So La Prusia, then we produce with the students a system by which this Park Foundation gave a seed loan to buy trucks. I mean, they wanted just out of charity just to give them money to buy these two trucks, this excavator to begin building the road. But we said we don't want to accept the money just as charity, that it will be repaid by the community, but not to the foundation, but to the community itself in the shape of this funding to then allow the community to borrow from in the shape of micro lending again, but with the agency that we designed somehow as the community became out of a condition of governance so that they could really monitor what types of projects would be articulated out of this funding. And then we're in the process of fixing the road, and ultimately that fund was the source for the housing, basically, to produce the housing and the transformation of this community into a construction company that is called La Prusia Construction Industry. So the trucks have just arrived in Nicaragua. And again, out of this system, of this sort of prefabricated, manually assembled truss, we are going to produce the first sheds that will have classrooms that will accommodate the trucks and for beginning to train some of the members of this community. The idea is simple, is that the community becomes co-owner of these resources, and they have organized themselves between volunteers, the nonprofit organization, and themselves to produce this economic system. And these are just very simple sheds that will they are being built at this moment in this neighborhood that utilize, you know, local materials such as bamboo and so on, but become the first sort of gesture in the construction of housing, which is really the second phase of the project. In essence, then, is this notion that to get to housing, we have to really produce, again, or design the economic base to make that housing sustainable in the long term. So that's what we are working on right now, the design of that microsystem.
Very good.
And now for something completely different?
Yes, well, but maybe linked to that question about fashion, which I think that is somehow, I remember a quote by José Ortega y Gasset that said that history is how we change our attention from one subject to the other, and there are, it is really curious how there's like suddenly subjects that were totally forgotten in this particular case. For instance, I was working on this project in May last year when I suddenly became interested in Marx, and people were telling me, well, why Marx is like totally outdated.
Out of fashion.
Yes. And suddenly he's back in the cover of Time magazine. Well, time is limited, so I'd rather go and show you the video, which is 5 minutes. It's just like a kind of teaser of the television series. And there's new characters added, but this is like a little bit